the essential podcast for educators in the UK. Made by teachers, for teachers.
Hello and welcome to Homework Podcast. Today we are going to look at what makes a good teacher. So obviously I'm joined by two spectacular specimens in front of me.
It's very kind.
So hello gentlemen.
Good morning.
And
are we going to steer clear of using the word outstanding teacher on this podcast, or we stick with good? What do you think?
Well, satisfactory.
Homework, the essential podcast for educators in the UK.
Let's go straight into it. So, are teachers born? Are teachers made? Are we just naturally spectacular human beings that are superior and different to everybody else? Or is there a certain set recipe, do we think?
I think there's obviously lots of attributes that we'll talk about in the next sort of 20 minutes or so that make a good teacher. For me, as a pupil, and something that I've tried to bring into my own sort of teaching practice, is pupil engagement. I think the teachers I sort of buzzed off, the teachers I felt that I interacted best with and wanted to learn for, were the teachers that really gave me a purpose to learning. They engaged me, they made me feel that what I was doing in that lesson had a meaning, and it actually was worth something. I think looking back on some of my time at primary school, secondary school, there were times that I would sit in a classroom going through the motions, and I wouldn't know quite why I was doing it, and for that reason I don't think that I was giving my best, and pupil engagement for me is something that I hold very highly.
I think what you're saying there is the sort of sense of feeling valued as well by your teacher. I think we've probably all sat on this table, had teachers in our sort of childhood that we have really adored, because I think we felt that they've valued us as individuals, and they've seen us as, for whatever reason, talented in an aspect of our learning, or something stood out that made us different to other children. But we've probably also got teachers who we can remember who probably didn't really take much time to get to know us, probably didn't see us as anything out of the ordinary in any way, shape or form. So I think feeling valued for me as a child was always something that I really appreciated, and I think made me sort of click with that teacher, and that sort of rapport that we are after as teachers with our children was what saw me sort of succeed. And particularly if I think about the subjects I did well in, there tended to be a link there between the teacher and our relationship, and how I therefore took that subject on further as I went on secondary school and even A level in my degree. Like, everything sort of followed a pattern, and I think that came from those teachers that really showed me respect, and it worked both ways.
So it's, I mean, I think what we're all saying, I mean, certainly I would say care. I think back on my certainly kind of, in fact, my primary and secondary kind of tenure, if you like, I think the people, the teachers that I remember are the ones that I felt genuinely cared. Mm-hmm. So I mean, are we saying that the actual kind of, almost the pastoral side is just as, if not more significant as the kind of being, as the kind of actual, here's the teaching standards, let's tick them off kind of thing? Because I think if you've genuinely, as a child, if you, I think it's easy to, I'm rambling, but I was reading a tweet this morning or yesterday, actually. I've totally forgotten the gentleman's name, but I really do enjoy his tweets on Twitter. And he was saying that he feels that the actual pay that
Mr. K teacher.
It's not Mr. K teacher.
No, it's definitely not.
Garbage. and he was saying that he feels that actually the starting salary for teaching isn't actually that bad at all, because he looks at his friends that he was at university with, and he said that the actual structure of teaching, he feels that pretty much all of them could do, whereas he couldn't necessarily do the things that they graduated in doing and are now doing as a career.
Mm, okay.
And I can see what he was saying in the sense of that, as much as I think that that teachers are naturals in terms of being a very good teacher, I do think that you could give most educated people a piece of paper that says teach this lesson like this, and they'd be able to do it. They might not use the correct assessment, or their questioning might need developing and all of that sort of stuff, but for me, I would honestly say that I think actually that rapport, that care, that extra kind of taking the time to get to know the individual child, that learning about the family background, all of that stuff that actually kind of makes that child tick, I think that's probably just as important, if not more important, than the actual nuts and bolts of assessment and planning.
Yeah, it's the relationships thing, isn't it? I'm sure we've all seen the Rita Pearson video going around YouTube for years, but
I posted it.
It's all for the likes.
What's it?
It's all for the likes.
At least he's honest.
But it is building those relationships. And as Ben says, I'm sure there's actually loads of people outside of teaching that I dare say would do a really good job in the classroom. And probably we touched on it a couple of episodes ago, and we were talking about routes into teaching, and we were saying routes through training providers are actually getting easier, maybe standards are lowering, but perhaps on that basis there are people who actually might be absolute naturals, might maybe not have quite the same academic background. Maybe they'll be able to, you know, patch that up or build upon that, but they have that ability to interact and relate to children in a way that is going to get the best out of them. I'm sitting amongst two football loving Adonises, or what do we say,
godlike man. That phrase we use in the PE,
linking to football. The Man United situation at the moment, when you mentioned getting the best out of people, being liked, the situation of Man United changing their manager, going from someone who very much had their way, this was the way that we do things, you know, players sort of being inhibited, not allowed to express themselves, that kind of made me think about the classroom and think how... looking at the way, excuse my Norwegian, but Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, looking at the way he's sort
you are
of...
Aware, you are aware that's English, it's just his name.
I've got no idea. Looking at the way he's sort of, I guess, using the flea in the jar analogy, how he's lifted that lid, how he's allowed players to...
Could you explain that? Sorry, I've not heard.
So I went to an inset day the other day, and the other year, I'd say, and they're talking about, like, if you put fleas in a jar with a lid for a certain period of time and then took the lid off, the fleas would only jump as high as the lid had had been placed. They were they're sort of conditioned to think that is the peak of their ability, and this has actually apparently been proved through experimentation. However, if you remove that lid, or if you'd never placed that lid, the ceiling on what they can achieve, the height they can jump is much higher. And I think linking that to my far-fetched football example, I think we're sort of seeing with Man United how if you can widen those boundaries, remove those shackles, the potential is much broader. And I think looking at the classroom, I've lost where I was going with this. So I'm really enjoying talking about football. If anyone wants to get me on a football podcast, that'd be
football
great.
Ramble.
But I think engagement is absolutely key.
I think to sum that up from that in a non-football related way, I think we are very
rugby.
Aware that probably subject knowledge could be imparted by, like you're saying, Ben, an educated individual who has certainly some aspects of prior learning in an area. I think there's no doubt that someone could do that. But I think we are very aware, as I'm sure the listeners, that in a classroom there are so many more things than just the teaching of a skill or of a subject that go on. And I think, like you were saying, the partial side of it, knowing your children, knowing that every single day a child could really have a tough time at home and they come in and they're in your environment. Mm-hmm. Someone could come into the room and probably teach a lesson but have no grasp of all those other areas that we deal with daily. And there's always that sort of comment that teachers are juggling 30 children at once, but also all the other issues that those children have. And I think that is the one difference between, I guess, us in the room, teachers, who have done it through the love of working with the children and also wanting to make a difference, and those who could just step into a lesson. And I think a lesson is very different to doing it as a career.
Yeah, I fully agree, yeah.
And I think probably, in years gone by, and it might still happen now, there are people who do degrees who almost fall into teaching.
Yeah, we've discussed that.
And we've said that before, history, science, geography, whatever subject it might be. But I think truly, to be a great teacher, it isn't just about imparting knowledge. Mm-hmm. It's all those other things aside.
Yeah, I fully agree. Just a shout out, Oliver Mills, I believe, was tweeting. If you do not follow Oliver,
he's got a cartoon sort of.
Yeah.
He's also hammering the use of resources being scammed online. So
I know Oliver's looking for an alternative of selling resources. I was just looking at his Twitter feed there, saying there's a market for the Spotify-esque kind of resources. So perhaps that's another podcast. Oh. But I do agree with Oliver, and I'm going to big him up here. Some of his tweets, I think, do draw the ire of some of the Twitterville, shall we say, because he can be quite cutting with some of the opinions. But honestly,
but
I think it's necessary. I think that Twitter needs a breath of fresh air like that. So Oliver, good on you.
Good lad, Oliver.
Is there any relevance?
No, it's just
Oliver.
T-shirt going your way. There is a point. In fact, that you're coming on to. You're just talking about teachers that kind of that sort of go that extra mile, if you like. But part of that, and I know it's a hotly debated topic, is that idea of external professional development and things like that. So there seems to be a real culture, a mixed culture at the moment, between those teachers that feel that it's perfectly acceptable for them to attend weekend conferences, for them to be using things like Twitter, for them to be reading children's books, and another kind of sector of the industry that feel actually that their job is their 9-to-5, for want of a better term, job, and that they should be kept up to date via inset training and things like that, that actually we already work some of the longest hours in the country, and that realistically, why should people have to go beyond? Do lawyers go to Saturday conferences? Do doctors have to go onto Twitter to share ideas? I mean, obviously I'm being facetious, but the point still stands. So is there an element of that, that a good teacher should be constantly pursuing their own professional development external to their school?
Something, or? I don't know why, but I think there's an internal drive, certainly from all manner of teachers I've met, everyone that obviously we see on Twitter, like has that in them, that they want to continuously grow. And I guess the world that we are living in, and particularly the world the children are living in, is always changing. Mm. And we're teaching children, and I think we see it as almost, we won't be judged if we don't, but I think if we do, we feel better potentially about ourselves, and we have more assets to share. And like David was mentioning before the podcast, like he picks up so much from Twitter that he often shares with our head. I think.
Do you think you're a better teacher because of it?
I think so.
I genuinely do.
I think it opens your eyes. I think you get, obviously, the three of us around the room could talk all day about teaching, all day about different ideas in the classroom, but as soon as you can reach out to the masses, which, let's be honest, 5-10 years ago wouldn't have happened, you're almost straight away opened up to far more opportunities.
I think what it also gives is just context. I think we know there's a workload problem in teaching. We know there's like a well-being issue with teachers and lots of anxiety, stress, all of the mental health aspects, but what these weekend meets do, what going on Twitter does, is it does take you out of your own school bubble. It does allow you to perhaps see maybe the grass is greener, and if it is, then find ways to exploit that. Maybe it isn't, and you might then return to your school with a new perspective. I think from that point of view alone, it's really, really interesting. I think one thing I was talking about only this week, we'll give another shout out, Matt Tirado, who went for lunch the other day, lovely Wagamamas, other Japanese food chains are available. He was talking about, we were just discussing teachers' knowledge of modern children's literature, and we were talking about should teachers be encouraged to read, should they have to read as part of their CPD to be able to
stay up to trend? Should they be given time to do that?
Yeah, and that's it, isn't it? Yeah. It's being given time to do that. It's often, I've seen some schools that do sort of remunerate, is that the word? I don't know. Children, teachers that go to weekend conferences, they then don't have to attend certain in-staff insets. Yeah. I think it's unrealistic and quite frankly unfair to expect teachers to give up, like just telling them they have to give up X amount of time to do the CPD, because the workload we already know is all-encompassing.
Yeah, especially when we're going to do a third shout-out now to baby David that's on the way. So big round of applause
from
everyone here at the Home Podcast.
Any names are welcome to
suggest. Yeah, that's a great idea. At Home Podcast.
We've written off Ben already.
So so there is a baby David on the way.
Oh my goodness.
I have a point here. Believe it or not, that we are all
Oliver Mills,
as we've discussed before.
Great bloke.
As we've discussed before, we are all currently at this point of the point in our lives where we can dedicate the time that we do. So I do have a huge degree of sympathy to people that perhaps don't have that level of free time, single parents or parents of any shape that are trying to juggle all of these plates or children, as we were saying earlier, Sam. But the other point I would make with that is I do think that a lot of the CPD or the professional development that we pick up on through Twitter or through Facebook or whatever does transcend and does eventually trickle into schools.
Yeah.
Even schools where people aren't doing those things. I just think it takes time.
Time is the key.
Like, you can find, like, there will be, and I'm sure we've all done it, that you'll see something online or you'll read something in the TES or whatever, and then 3 months later, someone's introducing it in your school, or someone's saying, oh, have you seen this great new idea? And the problem with that is that I think it can breed a certain amount of snobbery amongst the teacher, amongst the teaching faculties across the country, of those people that do engage and those people that don't. And it is that kind of, that I do feel there is a potential danger with the growing power of the monolithic edgy Twitter kind of beast. Yeah. That there is a concern, I think, perhaps amongst people that don't use it, that in whispered corridor conversations perhaps think that X, Y or Z teacher thinks they're better than others because they go on Twitter.
I think it can become all-consuming. Mm. Like, I think you can be quite distracted by it, and it can become a lot to deal with and engage with. I think you certainly as an individual need to have balance, and if it becomes too much, or you feel like at your school, possibly if you're in a school you're the only one, and you try and say, I picked up on Twitter, or I spoke to another teacher from this school, like they might think, yeah, but you could just talk to us.
Some people tarnish it with the whole social media, like, it's a fad,
it's too informal, it's too laid back. But I think there's lots of pros. There are obviously some cons, and you're right, there can be some negative things that can come from it, whether that's directly on there or people's views of it who aren't on there, because a lot of it's just conversation, isn't it?
I think
finding
from my
time is really tricky.
Yeah.
And that's the only outlay we have sometimes to have that in our day.
I think from my perspective as well, as a classroom teacher, whether you like it or not, you are being judged on your performance. Pay is linked to performance. You're asked, schools across the country to wheel out data, termly, half-termly, however regularly it's done, looking at specific children, specific groups, how they're performing. And I think subconsciously, delving into areas of CPD outside of the classroom, from my own perspective, I don't sort of consciously go to find things to make me a best teacher, I do think sort of layering my knowledge and experience through things like that just put me in a more comfortable position to be able to, like, to give my class the best I can. Right. And I think I do that because obviously I want the children to do really well, but at the same time, I do. It is part of my job, you know. I am getting judged on how my children perform, and I think to be the best teacher I can be, or give myself as much knowledge and equipment I can, like I think that helps.
I think as well, like, we as teachers, as a profession, as a group of people, like, we are in this together in the sense that we all want the same thing for our children, we want the best for them. And I think it works both ways. Like David, like Happy said, you've shared some really cool things that people have then used in their classrooms, and you're seeing the impact on those children.
Yeah,
and that's lovely.
I would say like when I started doing the reading review document, I mean, it's mind blowing. I do think like when you just think it's just a piece of paper that I've written about some books that have been reviewed, and it ends up going into like 250 different schools or something.
Well, how many children that can
actually, and that's it, and how many parents have read it, and you do actually think sometimes that
like pride as well.
Yeah, too right. And humbling completely. Yeah. But I mean, perhaps we need a long discussion on sort of the benefits of external CPD on another pod. But so just thinking about good teachers, do we think? And let's be fair and impartial to a point here. Do we think observations actually improve teaching, or is that the aim of observations? Do we think? Like, I'm talking, even if they're not necessarily graded, are we do as a mechanism of improving standards? Do observations work?
I think there's obviously a trend at the moment, and in some schools it will work fantastically well, but there's a trend of trusting teachers above all else. There's a trend of removing any sort of written marking, any sort of looking at planning, any sort of observations. It's unlikely schools do all three, but that is a wave, isn't it? Now, I think it's all about trust, and it's all about whether the teachers do feel that the people observing them, the people that are delivering feedback, whether they think those people are doing it really in their best interest, whether they think someone's coming into their classroom to critique, or whether they think they're coming into the classroom just to get a taste of it and see what it's like. Our school this year, and I openly talk about it, we've moved to more frequent drop-ins. I really like that. I think it's nice that I think I've got very much an open door of my classroom. People often come in. I've received really positive feedback for that. I've received some constructive next step from that, but I think the way it works, the fact is shorter drop-ins, more frequent, I think for that reason I feel that they're getting a bit more of a taste of what my day-to-day teaching is like. And it might be they come in one time and we're doing a bit of a transition, and they're not seeing progress at that point, but they might be seeing something else, a bit of behavior management, whatever. I think if you feel it's teacher training, isn't it? We did skit training, I don't know how you train, but that is very much isolated lesson. Mm-hmm. Come in, tick every teacher standard you can. It doesn't look like a normal lesson at all. It's a tick box exercise.
Especially as you say, if we know for a fact that pay is now linked to performance. Yeah. So there is that pressure of if you're having an observation in inverted commas and the lesson doesn't go particularly well, you start to get that kind of prickling sensation on the back of your neck. And certainly for families and things like that, and people, young people trying to get on the property ladder, like that relatively small but still significant pay rise is a big impact on perhaps many, many people's lives. And if you are not good under pressure, if you don't feel comfortable in that kind of environment, that suddenly you can find yourself in what's just meant to be a monitoring visit or just a friendly checkup. You can suddenly actually start getting quite paranoid or concerned that you're being judged negatively and what impacts that can have further afield. And the quality of teaching then surely is less than if you were actually at ease and felt...
And it also doesn't feed back to you what your typical day-to-day lesson is like. If you're putting on a showy observation... Mm. You're then getting feedback on that, positive or negative, but it's not necessarily making you a best teacher, because your next lesson the next day isn't going to look like that. So you don't have as much time to plan every, we're talking about drop-in observations, something like one-off lessons, I guess.
Yeah, I think, like you're saying, you can't also judge a 1 hour or however long that observation would be. Also because the children are very different. Like they know it's quite a sort of staged, sort of very showy off lesson where you are probably not being your normal Mr. Stewart, Mr. King, Mr. Key. You're being someone a little bit different.
Yeah,
and the children know that. I think for me, it's worth mentioning that this year I'm a skip mentor, so I'm observing weekly and providing very sort of detailed formal feedback through all of the teaching standards, and there's lots of targets. And for that stage in your teaching career, I think it's essential. I think it's really important because you're getting concurrent, ongoing feedback throughout a year, and you should be seeing your progress and areas of weakness and areas for development.
And it's how we ensure quality
of... That, I think, is completely justified. I think one thing, like David said, the drop-ins we've had this year have been, I think, quite refreshing. We have still had sort of formal observations that, like, touch wood for me, have gone really well, but I can see that like you're saying, when performance is pay is based on performance, livelihoods are at stake. If you aren't someone that copes, I think you're completely right, but that can put a really, really high level of pressure on you.
And you could be a fantastic teacher.
And you could, and actually, three observations a year could determine your pay, essentially, and
linked to data
and book looks and things, but like, let's be honest, you could be unwell or you could have had something going on at home. Like, if it's just judged on those moments, that's a tricky situation to find yourself in.
I do think it's difficult. I think that I do respect that SLT have an obligation to kind of ensure that they have a knowledge of what's going on in their school, but as you say, like, that I think is far more effectively done by just a constant low level presence. It's high stakes, high frequency, low stakes. I mean, my class would find it odd if they didn't see the head teacher in my classroom every day, and that might only be 16 seconds, but it might also be that I'm in the middle of reading a story, I turn around and he's sat at my desk just listening.
Sure.
Like, for them, it isn't abnormal to see him.
That's good, that is
a really crucial way for staff as well. And obviously, we still get nervous about our formal observations, but I think that is really crucial for staff to feel like that. It's not kind of the be all and end all. Like, it's not.
And if he does drop in your room, and you don't get picked up on it, it's nice, isn't it? No, but as in, you know that, like, there's not been anything going wrong, and, you know, it just reassures you that when it does come to something that's a little bit more formal, he'll have seen enough to know that you can teach.
You also, you don't want to see it as us and them.
Yep.
I think SLT obviously could be potentially seen as very different to the teaching staff, and I think you want to knock down those barriers between the two parties, because if you're saying that your head teacher is often coming to your classroom, that puts you at ease as a teacher, and it's less daunting, it's less threatening.
I'm more concerned if I don't see it.
Yeah. But I think that sounds like a lovely touch.
Yeah, and I think there's lots of ways. I mean, I know a lot of these ideas came from or are derivations of things like teach like a champion, etc. And we do kind of peer-to-peer observations where he teaches and we're released to go and observe our colleagues in the same school
for an hour.
So we start off in one class. It used to be that we were just in one class for the entire lesson, and now we start off in one class and then we wander the school, which is great because it means that I can go and see little things in year three and year six and year two and even right down to reception, because there's also just ensuring that us as professionals have a knowledge of the whole school sphere.
Yeah,
to be quite frank, in my training, in my career until I came to where I am now, I'd never been in a reception classroom. No. When it was in mid-flow, because I hadn't ever had the opportunity. I mean, I think I'd spent 20 minutes during my NQT release time, but because I'd always viewed myself as a Key Stage 2 teacher, it wasn't really a priority for me. So,
do you think, when we spoke at the beginning about what makes a good teacher, do you think like environment does dictate that to some extent? Do you think there's good teachers in deprived, tricky catchments who are really good there, but there's good teachers who are a much better fit in slightly different catchments, as in you get a good teacher in Key Stage 1, could they not be a good teacher in Key Stage? I know that there is transference, but
I think a lot of that for me comes down to personality. I did a term in year 2 due to kind of restructuring in the school, and as much as I enjoyed that, I didn't enjoy it anywhere near as much as I enjoyed teaching in year 5, because my personality, I enjoy having that bit of banter with the kids, of still having that level of silliness, but still being able to have that kind of slightly that football chat with some of the kids that are interested in it, and the kind of, you know, when you have your playful kind of mickey taking with the kids, knowing that
I've got colleagues that love
being in Key Stage 1 because they love the fact that everything is still new, and it's that magical mind mentality where we're still kind of able to make believe and that kind of aspect. So, and again, I would say in really kind of challenging, difficult schools, even more so, those pastoral skills that we were talking about, and perhaps an awareness of a broader range of cultures and that kind of elements. I mean, I've taught in an outstanding school, and I've taught in a special measures school, and
Ben is a man for all occasions.
Jack of all trades, just shows how old I'm getting, they are transferable skills, but I do think that I bet a lot of people stay in the same Key Stage for their entire career. That's perhaps what I'm trying to say.
I'm sure it's not.
Go ahead, Sam.
Sorry, just a question that just came into my head when you were speaking, but I think just, and it will be very hard to answer, and it's not even for now necessarily, but just, is a good teacher a good teacher in anywhere they go? Or does actually the place, like you're saying, the environment, does that actually shape how good or how bad a teacher could potentially be?
And does a good teacher challenge perhaps what the structure of the school is if they think that it needs challenging? Do you know what I mean? I think there's a lot of teachers that I think just kind of, if stuff comes out from SLT or from the LEA or whatever, then it's kind of, all right, okay, we'll do it like that. Whereas perhaps sometimes things need to actually be, like, we are the professionals, we are the experts in terms of our classrooms. Perhaps I do worry that in schools that are perhaps smaller, perhaps staff that have been there for a long time, and there's perhaps new blood coming in, I do worry that sometimes schools can get a little stale.
I think it's probably not a conversation for this specific podcast, but when you mentioned, Ben, that there's probably a lot of teachers that stay in the same Key Stage for their entire career, it'd be really interesting to hear from people who have progressed to leadership roles about what experience they had. I think I've certainly heard that to be a head teacher you really need to get experience in Key Stage 1 and 2. Like, I don't know if that necessarily is still seen as the way, but I do think you're right. And even within schools you often get year teachers who are seen as like year 3 teachers or lower Key Stage or upper Key Stage teachers.
There's benefits to that I think a lot of teachers quite like that, partly because it just means they know the curriculum, the
planning's easy,
they've done the planning, etc. But I do think there's a danger potentially of de-skilling in that regard, especially if you're not leading a subject that perhaps requires a huge depth of knowledge of the curriculum in every year. If you're leading English and maths, you have to know when everything is brought in.
Skill progression, isn't it?
Yeah, and not to say that in history and geography you don't need to know that, but there's obviously not the same depth to it. So I do think that perhaps sometimes teachers naturally, because we're so drained and so tired and so well-meaning, focus obviously on the kids in front of them, and that can perhaps sometimes mean that they finish, if you like, with that batch and send them off to the next year group and wait for the next delivery in September.
I think it's almost like the bit of a mastery skill with a teacher, deepening your understanding of a certain year group, and you will, I feel, get better year after year, or changing year groups every year, you're almost relearning the curriculum, how to plan and deliver lessons to that particular age group. So it's an interesting question, and a balance that I think's particularly, like, certainly where I am now, like, there's a lot of teachers at our school though that sort of do stick to those year groups and
do you think, quite set.
And yeah. I've only done year six prior to this year with year, now year five. And that, for me, was just quite an interesting change.
Mm.
Like after a couple of years in year six, even though it's only just 1 year...
Yeah, my year group partner is saying the same thing, actually. She's just stepped down from year six to year five. Mm.
Different pressures as
and
well.
And she said it is very different. The kids, like, we forget they're a whole year of maturity younger and all of that side of it. I mean, there was we had an interesting discussion on Twitter, I think this was last year, about this premise that the better you are, the higher up the school you are. If we're thinking about good teachers, what makes a good teacher, do we think that there is truth in the fact that schools put, and I'm not saying this is the case, but this was discussed, that schools put their best teachers in year six?
I think there's a lot of damage done if you do that, because by the time you get to year six, if you haven't done much teaching before that, there's an awful lot of catch up. If you look at the breakdown in the SATs papers, there's a bulk of the questioning is not year six curriculum as
true,
such,
but
is
the
it?
The idea would be that year six teachers being the best teachers would be more efficient at revising that content. I mean, let's be frank. If we anonymously surveyed every head teacher in the country, do we think that there would be a relatively high or a relatively reflective percentage that said, honestly, if they had to rank their staff, do they put their best teachers in year two and year six?
My answer would be, I don't know.
Sam's smiling, and I think that I reckon that there would be.
I think it's probably a certain type
of individual, though, isn't it? Like, I think when you mention about like revising, testing,
data.
I think there's probably a certain type of teacher that would probably
efficient,
do yeah, very machine, very efficient, very yeah, very very good at data, very organised. Like, probably quite experienced in year six. Mm-hmm. I think those things. However, I think if you start those same teachers in year one, and we're trying to get them to teach early number, for example, it might be a whole different ball game, and you might have teachers in those Key Stage 1 classes which are absolutely fantastic at that very early understanding, that if they weren't able to convey that to the children, might massively detriment themselves moving forward. So I think it's so tricky. Maybe the head teachers would stick their best bets, if you like, in year six, but I don't know.
Or their safest hands, if you like, perhaps. Like, I mean, I think it's really tough, and hat off to you, Sam, to come in as an NQT and teach year six, not because it's the teaching is any harder, if you like, but there are greater pressures. It'd be absolutely obtuse of us to sit here and say, I've taught year five, excuse me, for 3 years now, and it's absolute hokum to suggest that I have the same pressure on me that the year six teachers do. Because as much as, and I think a lot of head teachers are very good at when the data comes out saying this is a whole school achievement, etc., it is their necks on the line, in that, metaphorically speaking, that if that data is appalling and it wasn't predicted that it was going to be appalling, then there is an issue there. Yeah. So I do have some sympathy.
In the same way that your year five data, when you get it at the end of this year, it's not going to be year four's data, is it? Like, you know, you are going to be judged on your year five data. Yeah, year six will be judged on year six data. Yeah. However much we talk about the learning beforehand.
I think the data obviously in year six is what a school is held to. And I think SATs data is obviously, unfortunately for some, the be all and end all.
Yeah.
And we do forget a lot of other things.
Yeah.
But I think you are right, the pressure there is immense. And I think the biggest difference I found this year, stepping down just 1 year group to year five, is that, and whether it's right or wrong, I'm not sure, but in year six, I felt every single lesson was absolutely crucial.
Yeah.
And I was very, very self-reflective. If I felt like a lesson hadn't gone very well, I was quite hard on myself.
Did you take more notice of absence and stuff like that?
Yeah, oh, everything. Absences, like, just little things like children, like, going to get a drink in class. Like, it sounds silly, but you feel the pressure.
Same,
And I think, like, when you do mock SATs and you've got X amount in maths, English reading, SPAG reading, are currently meeting. These aren't, but they should be.
Yeah, there's a cold sweat.
Panic station, there is. And it, don't get me wrong, it feels amazing when they get there. But in year five, I felt so much less pressure.
And it almost comes back, full circle to what we started by talking about, which is the fact that you care. And you care about those kids, and you care about yourself, and you care about school, and you care, most people care about their SLT as well. Like, you care about your colleagues. You don't, like, there is an absolute feeling, I certainly have it, of not wanting to let anyone down.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think there's this sort of trait in teaching of people always feeling, am I actually good enough for this job?
It creates two like lines of conversation as well, what Sam's just said. Like, on one hand, does that mean that maybe there should be more urgency in the other year groups? Or on the other hand, is there too much urgency in year six? And should do you know what I mean? That there's two contrasting arguments there.
Totally,
potentially, like all year groups should have that level of urgency, and then maybe it won't get to year six and have the catch up. Maybe the SATs thing is too all encompassing. I don't have the answer.
And it is that thing. Pressure and mental health and stress and workload and everything else. Not to mention the fact that we, again, a feed that I saw this week, an awful lot of secondary schools completely ignore the Key Stage 2 data, do CATS tests, and then reassess and set them anyway. So let's be fair, 90% of the motivation for SATs testing is for Ofsted.
Of course.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I'm plucking at a figure, but if you were to say to schools up and down the country, you can run your own formative assessment, totally independent, or you can do the SATs, nobody minds, like, we'll just want to see the data when we come in, scrap league tables, which are just complete fabrication.
It's for Ofsted, isn't it? And it's also for, I guess, which is linked to Ofsted, but just getting that continual intake, bums on seats each year, being the school that actually, you know, like, you want to have a...
There's nothing to stop you doing your own assessment to represent that. I think that perhaps comes into it. I mean, we're digressing into assessment here, but yeah, so I think that it's a really interesting discussion. What makes a good teacher? Is there such... are there traits that are better to have as a teacher or not? And we would obviously love to hear your views on this one as well. A really interesting topic. And again, that idea of, do you put your best teachers at the top of the school? So please let us know what you think on our Twitter feed, and we'll be back with you soon.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you, guys.
For much more content exclusively for teachers by teachers, visit homeworkmagazine.co.uk. Also, please follow us on social media at homework_magazine and at homework_podcast. Homework Podcast is brought to you by Iguanas Producciones.